WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. That's music from the film score for The Magnificent Seven. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the composer Elmer Bernstein. He died Wednesday at the age of 82. His film themes include The Great Escape, The Grifters, The Man with the Golden Arm, To Kill a Mockingbird, and most recently, Far From Heaven. Also, actor Peter Sarsgaard. His films include Shattered Glass, Boys Don't Cry, and the new one, Garden State. And film critic David Edelstein reviews We Don't Live Here Anymore. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There are conflicting accounts of the situation in the southern Iraqi city of Najaf, where U.S. and Iraqi government forces have been fighting Shiite militiamen for more than 2 weeks. The Iraqi government said at some points that Iraqi security forces had secured a Shiite holy site that had been occupied by the militia. At other times, they've said the shrine is still in militia control. NPR's Ivan Watson says fighting in the city appears to have died down.
Overnight on Thursday night, the U.S. military unleashed a really massive artillery assault and airstrikes against suspected militant targets in the center of Najaf around the shrine of Imam Ali, where fighters loyal to Muqtada Sadr have fortified themselves for more than 2 weeks. There was a lull starting before dawn and continuing throughout much of the day, though some skirmishes continued.
NPR's Ivan Watson. John Kerry made a rare campaign stop in North Carolina today. Scott Jagow reports from member station WFAE in Charlotte.
Kerry met with laid-off workers at a community college retraining center and then gave a speech to several hundred people on campus. His visit was the first by a Democratic presidential nominee to Charlotte in 12 years. North Carolina is usually a shoe-in for Republicans, but Kerry and his running mate, North Carolina Senator John Edwards, are trying to keep the state in play. Kerry told supporters his economic plan would benefit North Carolina, where thousands of people have lost their jobs.
We're going to create a tax credit for manufacturing. We're going to help employers be able to hire new people by relieving them from the burden of the payroll tax for 2 years, so it's cheaper to be able to actually go out and hire people.
Kerry said he would also invest more in education, both student loans and worker training. For NPR News, I'm Scott Jagow in Charlotte.
President Bush remains at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, taking a break from campaigning and preparing for his acceptance speech at the upcoming Republican National Convention. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Crawford.
Normally, the president spends the entire month of August at his ranch, relishing the time outside Washington and even claiming to enjoy the oftentimes oppressive summer heat in this part of Texas. This year, campaign demands have forced him to cut back on his time here. The president's aides say Mr. Bush has been going over the draft version of his convention speech. He's scheduled to speak on September 2nd, the final night of the Republican convention in New York. The president has been in Crawford since Wednesday night. He'll be here through next Thursday. In addition to working on his speech, on Monday, the president is scheduled to meet with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to discuss the ongoing reorganization of the U.S. military and the situation in Iraq. Don Gagne, NPR News in Crawford, Texas.
In stocks, the Dow gained 69 points to close at 10,110 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 18 to 1838. This is NPR News. India has promised action against all those responsible after two of its female weightlifters tested positive for drugs at the Olympic Games. They're the first Indians to fail a drug test at the world's most prestigious sporting event. Veer Singh reports from Delhi.
News of a second positive drugs test in as many days has shocked Indian officials trying to boost the country's poor sporting image. India's sports minister says he will consult with the officials after they return from the games in Athens, but has promised strict action against those found guilty. Both female weightlifters have been suspended. Newspaper and TV reports here have called for an official investigation into whether the use of performance-enhancing drugs has become become widespread. One of the women named this week has been suspended for testing positive at an earlier international event. The Indian Olympic Association says it has launched an investigation into the matter. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
Attorney General John Ashcroft announced indictments today against three men accused of helping to finance the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The three include Musa Mohammed Abu Marzouk, now thought to be living in Damascus, Syria. Marzouk was the former chief of the Hamas Political Bureau. Two other men were arrested today in the U.S. They are Mohammed Saleh of Chicago and Abdul Halim Ashkar of Alexandria, Virginia. Prosecutors said the men engaged in racketeering conspiracy on behalf of Hamas for at least 16 years, conspiring to commit murder, passport fraud, and other crimes. A lawyer for one of the men said the indictment was politically motivated. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, providing humanitarian aid in Sudan's Darfur region and working to prevent further violence there at ajws.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Elmer Bernstein, one of the great composers of Hollywood films, died Wednesday at his home in Ojai, California, at the age of 82. The more than 200 movies he scored ranged from classics like To Kill a Mockingbird to comedies like Animal House. Here's a sampling of his work. That was music from the films The Great Escape, The Sweet Smell of Success, The Ten Commandments, The Magnificent Seven, Far From Heaven, and The Man with the Golden Arm, all by composer Elmer Bernstein, who died Wednesday. Bernstein trained to be a concert pianist, but soon found that his love was writing for movies. His career was sidetracked for 5 years during the McCarthy era, but unlike many blacklisted artists, Bernstein actually considered himself a communist and spoke out on many leftist causes. He got back into major movies in 1955, when Otto Preminger hired him for The Man with the Golden Arm. Bernstein spent the next four decades composing in Hollywood, receiving 14 Academy Award nominations, but winning only once, for Thoroughly Modern Millie in 1967. Terry Gross spoke to Elmer Bernstein in 1991. They began by talking about his score for The Grifters, Stephen Frears' movie about con artists. Here's the opening theme.
Thank you. The Grifters is a most unusual film, stylistically, and basically what it's about. I mean, we've all seen films about con men before, but this is a very, very special film with a very special atmosphere. Let me put it this way. I think the two critics who reviewed the film, one of them spoke of the score as wittily ironic, and another one said that it was playfully unsettling. I think both of those critics caught what I was trying to do, which really answers the question.
And I think part of the way you get at that is the odd places that you'll hear percussion, like the odd rhythms that they play and the dissonances that you bring in.
Well, yes. First of all, the thematic material itself is very odd. Its closest relation would be the kind of things that they were doing in Europe, particularly Germany in the early 30s. It brings to mind perhaps something like Three Penny Opera. It is a sort of faintly decadent and faintly off-center, which sort of sets the whole atmosphere for the film itself.
In a way, I think that The Grifters builds on some of your innovations from The Man with the Golden Arm, a movie that you scored in 1955, in the sense that it's a very urban music. It's a jazz-inspired music. And I think it really set a trend off. The movie starred Frank Sinatra as a jazz drummer and drug addict. So obviously it made sense to use a jazz score, but what else went behind the thinking of that?
Well, if we go back to The Man with the Golden Arm, it is precisely as you said. I mean, the atmosphere was Chicago. I mean, that's where it took place. Chicago is one of the great homes of early jazz. The main character in the film wanted to be a jazz drummer. And as a matter of fact, one of the crucial scenes in the film is when he goes to an audition as a drummer and tries to get himself a job. And that's where the idea of the jazz score grew. Jazz had been used before, more sparingly in scores. I think what made The Man with the Golden Arm seem special at the time was that the use of jazz was throughout the film, and a lot of the so-called scoring pieces, the dramatic background pieces, were also jazz-based. But the feeling for using jazz stemmed from the mise-en-scène and the main character.
Let me play some of the music you wrote from The Man with the Golden Arm, and then we'll talk more about the score.
Okay.
Music from The Man with the Golden Arm, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. This was at the very beginning of the period when jazz ended up being used a lot for detective movies and TV shows and hard-boiled movies and TV shows.
I'm not so sure. You know, it depends on what you mean. The Man with the Golden Arm was 1955. In 1957, you get Peter Gunn, which was Henry Mancini doing a score which was basically jazz-oriented. And then in 1958, a show called Staccato went on the air with John Cassavetes, also about a detective, for which I did the score, also jazz-oriented. So, I mean, history, I've had very mixed feelings about with the man with the golden arm. Of course, I really cherish the memory of Man with the Golden Arm because it was actually the film that, so to speak, established my career. It did something else, which I have since regretted. Studios suddenly realizing how powerful the use of popular medium can be in a film score, because that hadn't been done in quite that way before. Not quite in the way I did in Man with the Golden Arm. Not so thoroughly. And the effect of it, of course, was that the record album from the score was immensely successful. And it just sort of seemed to open up the floodgates. And from then on, score after score after score was using popular music of some kind, either jazz, and then finally it went to rock and roll scores. And unfortunately, a lot of this kind of music was used for its commercial value rather than its appropriateness to the dramatic action.
Composer Elmer Bernstein speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1991 interview with Hollywood composer Elmer Bernstein. He died Wednesday at the age of 82.
Well, just about the same time that you were writing The Man with the Golden Arm, you were also writing the score for The Ten Commandments, which I think is one of the great movie religious epics. What kind of music to you seemed appropriate for a religious epic? You certainly want it to be big. And, of course, in Ten Commandments, you had to have music that was not only behind Moses, but behind God, you know? This is a tall order.
Yes, but we forgot something even more important.
What, Cecil B. DeMille?
And that's Cecil B. DeMille. <You're right. laughs> We'll never forget Cecil B. DeMille. Actually, DeMille was very, I mean, I found that was probably the most interesting experience in my whole life in the movie business, working with Cecil B. DeMille on that film. The music for the film was basically, the concept of the music was Wagnerian because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical cliches?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. well, necessarily so. I mean, you know, it's very interesting about that. When we finished the Ten Commandments, the music of the Ten Commandments, and I'd gotten to the point at that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, Mr. DeMille, sir, and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ? He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross, in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politic, so to speak. And DeMille said, you know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore in the atmosphere which exists in the world today. Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the cliches, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age, and I think indeed it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene. for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway... where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who plays shofars, of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage. playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals. There's about 8,000 people. And they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it, and he hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble. It looks like the picture. And the picture is too slow. He said... now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have, that accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now, but it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical because... eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
That's terrific. Let's get to another score that you wrote. This is such a great theme. I'm thinking of the theme from The Magnificent Seven, which was a Western epic based loosely on the Seven Samurai. Now, you wrote the theme for this. It was also a big pop hit. It was in the top 40, a version conducted by Al Caiola.
Yes, Al Caiola did a sort of guitar arrangement of it.
Yeah, so was that good for you? Did you wish you had the hit?
No, I'm basically very unselfish that way. I'm funny about that. I don't like to see the attitudes of the music changed, and in that sense, the Al Caiola thing was very, very different. That bothered me a little bit. No, it didn't bother me that he had a hit because, I mean, obviously it was very good for me. The best thing that ever happened from a purely economic point of view that happened with the Magnificent Seven is the theme was leased by a certain tobacco company.
I mean, we could say the name. People remember the Marlboro commercials with
right, the Marlboro
with
commercial. And that's terribly funny. When I perform this piece at concerts, especially in Europe where they still use those commercials, you know, where they can still do those kinds of cigarette commercials, I can hear the whisper go through the audience. They hear it, and of course they know it better as the Marlboro thing.
Well, Elmer Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thank you.
Composer Elmer Bernstein speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Bernstein died Wednesday at his home in Ojai, California at the age of 82. Here is Elmer Bernstein's theme from the film The Magnificent Seven. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From The Atlantic Monthly, looking inside Al-Qaeda's hard drive, Dixie Chick politics, and the rise of Barack Obama, on newsstands and at theatlantic.com. And by the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity on October 3rd. GIC on the web at www.german.info/unity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Peter Sarsgaard. He played a menacing character in Boys Don't Cry and a victim in Dead Man Walking. He's currently starring in Garden State. And David Edelstein reviews We Don't Live Here Anymore. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Peter Sarsgaard stars in the new film Garden State from writer, director, and actor Zach Braff, who plays Andrew Largeman in the film. Sarsgaard plays Mark, a high school friend of Andrew's who's never left town or had any big ambitions. When Andrew returns home for his mother's funeral, he finds Mark is still getting high and pulling scams for cash. In this scene, they're in a houseware store. Mark has picked up a box of knives and walks over to the returns department.
Why are you buying knives? I don't need knives.
I'd like to return these.
You got a receipt?
Actually, no, they're a gift.
Why are you returning these?
They're not sharp enough.
They're not sharp enough?
No, not for what we need them for. They couldn't cut cans.
You bought them to cut cans?
No, but in the commercial it said if I wanted to cut cans, I could.
Well, it comes with a sharpener. Did you try it?
Yeah. They're just... I don't want them. Okay. They're not sharp enough.
Okay.
Sarsgaard got his start in Dead Man Walking, and he co-starred in K-19 and Shattered Glass. His breakthrough performance was in Boys Don't Cry, based on the true story of Tina Brandon, a young woman with a sexual identity crisis who moved to a new town, dressed as a boy, fell in love with another woman, and was killed by the woman's ex-boyfriend. Sarsgaard played that boyfriend, Jack Lauder. Here's a scene in which Lauder and his ex-girlfriend Lana are at a birthday party for Tina Brandon, who's now using the name Brandon Tina. John's not only jealous, he suspects that Brandon isn't what he says he is. As they watch Lana dance, John sits down next to Brandon and puts his arm around him in a half-friendly, half-menacing way.
She's beautiful, isn't she? Oh, man. I know, since she was like this high. I could tell you stories about her. You know, kind of stories. She told me about you guys. And I can't think of a better guy to give Lana to than you, so happy birthday!
Thanks, Joe.
You know, just one thing. You gotta remember, little man, is this is my house.
Come on, turn up the music!
Later in the film, John Lauder rapes and murders Brandon Tina. When Terry spoke to Sarsgaard last year, she asked him about portraying such an unlikable character.
I remember reading a story about John Lauder before we started. It was about he was being taken to a reform school by his mother, and he was going along the highway. And you know, I don't know how fast they're going, but he really, really did not want to go to reform school, and he was very, very close with his mother. And he was very upset, and he jumped out of the car as the car was moving because he wanted to be with his mother so badly. And that, I think that was a very significant story to me when I heard about it. And that's not so much playing someone as, because his life is so different than mine, something like that sort of allows me to love him. You know, which is what you have to do with those characters.
Well, empathy is so important when you're acting, but when you're, I imagine it's hard to find empathy for somebody who's not a good person.
Yeah. I mean, you know, your director really helps you in that situation because they, on that movie, Kim Pierce, the director, made me feel like, she made me feel like a stud. And the sheriff of the town, that I was a kind of law enforcement, you know, albeit my law, which was had some kindness to it. Like, I did not want to mete out the punishment. It was not something that I felt like I was being forced to do it, which is, you know, a kind of psychology that Kim just worked over on me, you know, and a good director will do that. They'll just start seeing the world through your eyes with you, you know, like over your shoulder, going, look at this new guy who came into town and is now your girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, is all over him. This is the woman who is the only person that wrote letters to John Lauder when he was in jail. And, you know, really his only connection to the real loving world that we all know. And so, You know, at first, my bad feelings toward Brandon Tina in that movie have nothing to do with the fact that it's a woman dressed as a man, or, you know, it really has to do with the fact that a very small man that looks like I could beat up is taking my ex-girlfriend from me.
I know some people who didn't see Boys Don't Cry because they didn't think they could sit through what they knew was coming, which was that she, you know, that Brandon Tina, Tina Brandon, gets beaten, gets raped, gets killed. Can you talk about what it was like to do those difficult scenes?
Yeah, I mean, it can be very technical some of the time. I mean, you're obviously... My main concern doing those scenes is that I don't hurt the other person. And so frequently, you know, I've been on both sides of violent scenes in movies, and I always prefer to be on the receiving end because you don't have to worry, you know. The main problem in doing them is that you want it to look real. You want it to, because the fake version of that, I think, is kind of socially irresponsible. But so you want it to have a sense of reality, but you also don't want to hurt your co-star. So that's mainly what's going through my mind a lot of the time. And because of that, it's hard to indulge all of the animal instinct stuff that comes up in you while you're doing it, you know. You need to have people there that know what they're doing and give you all the equipment you need. I mean, in terms of doing a rape scene, you have to figure out logistically what you're doing, you know. I mean, it's the kind of stuff nobody talks about, but it's like you have to take down your pants, because people do when they do it, and that will not look real for the movie. And presumably she wouldn't have hers on, but then we don't want, you know, it's uncomfortable. And so in that movie, we actually put a dam in at one point to try to, you know, just to have something literally from me to hit when I was raping her. So it's incredibly, I mean, when I'm talking about it in that way that's so detailed, you can understand how it's not just doing a rape scene. It's like a whole logistical thing with people's feelings and people's bodies and trying to take care of everyone.
Did you find yourself apologizing to Hilary Swank because you had to treat her rough in the scenes?
I didn't, no. I didn't, because it seemed like the amount that it was upsetting her was not an amount that was going to affect her life, you know, like how, you know, her daily life as she went out, but that it might be good in the scene. And, you know, after we finished the movie, she and I, you know, patted each other on the back, and I congratulated her on her Academy Award and everything and felt so good about it. And we're friends now. But while we were doing it, if I had apologized each time after I did a take or something, I mean, it's... Then I'm not John Lauder, and she's, you know, it makes her job harder, I think.
Your first film role, I think this was your first role, was in Dead Man Walking.
Yeah.
What was your part in the role? I should say.
I was the boy who was raped and murdered. The reason Sean Penn goes to death row, he rapes and murders my girlfriend and I. So, yeah, that was another rape scene. I'd been on the receiving end, say, from that movie.
Well, did that help, having been on the receiving end in a movie?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, because I knew doing Boys Don't Cry and doing the rape scenes and everything that, you know, Hillary, who's the victim in that scene, once as an actor, for that all of this effort that you're going through, and it's physical and it's emotional and it's all these different things, that if you're only going to do it halfway, it's really almost as hard as doing it the whole way. And that you really might as well go all out, you know, because we don't need to see sort of how it happens in movies. Isn't it going to be more effective and more informative in our lives if we see closer to how it might really happen? And, you know, Sean Penn always errs on the side of it might really happen, you know. So, and Sean very much took care of me and Missy Yeager, who played the girl in that scene. I mean, the next day, everyone got us massages and everything. And I mean, it was, that scene was very elaborate also because we got thrown down in the mud and then raped and murdered. But obviously, to do another take, we had to go take showers, get dried off, put on makeup and our clothes, and go do it again from being dry and not muddy, because we were filming in the bayou in Louisiana. So, you know, that scene went on all night, you know.
So did being, like, really tired as the night wore on help in looking like a scared and under attack young man?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helped actually wear me down. I think takes probably 1 through 4 were unusable because I'd never been in a movie before. So I actually, the energy that I had from just having a camera pointed at me and acting with Sean Penn and doing all of this, it was probably too much, you know. So by the 8th take, I'm sure it was just
they had to beat
more
you
reasonable.
Down first.
Right. It was more reasonable. It was like the Stanley Kubrick style. Beat the actor down until they just will do it.
Peter Sarsgaard speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. He's now starring in the film Garden State. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with actor Peter Sarsgaard.
You were an English and history major at Washington University. What had you planned on doing when you were in college?
I wanted to be a writer, actually. One of the reasons I went to Washington University was because Stanley Elkin, a very great short story writer and novelist, was teaching there. And I, you know, was just a huge fan. And so I got to meet Stanley, and I actually performed his short story, Poetics for Bullies, which is in the Criers, Kibitzers, and Criers collection. And then it turned out William H. Gass was teaching there, who's also an incredible thinker and novelist. And Howard Nemiroff was there at the time, and I just became sort of like, I don't know that I learned anything from any one of these guys except just to be around people that were just so fully committed to something so specific. You know, that Stanley's writing is so specific, and he did it his entire life.
Well, Stanley Elkin had MS, and toward the end of his life, he was, you know, very, very, very sick and had lost a lot of physical functioning. What was it like to be around somebody who was both your mentor but was very disabled at the same time?
Well, you know, he's in a wheelchair. I mean, you never know with Stanley, because I mean, he's just he sort of made humor out of bile, you know. I mean, which is like a lemonade out of lemons. I mean, I remember one of his stories. It's about a guy in a wheelchair who has to go to the bathroom, and his wife leaves him right as he has to go to the bathroom, and he has to figure out how to go to the John. And that's how the story starts. So Stanley always had, like, a great deal of humor about his circumstances, I think, and just a keen, keen wit, and that's something that no disease could kill in you.
Why did you abandon the idea of writing?
A combination of I wasn't sure I was very good at it, and also, it's not sitting alone writing is not in my personality. You know, I very much need someone to say action and cut. I need people to make me do what I do for a living. I have a whole team of people that send me scripts and make sure I read them and ask me questions about them. And then you work with a director who you want to serve, and I work better when there's a group that I can disappoint. You know, if I were writing, if I were writing, the only person I could disappoint would be myself, and I'm too willing to do that.
Oh, you'd have an editor you could disappoint.
Oh, okay, great.
So, but, so what led you to acting?
Well, at first, a little bit randomly, I just started doing plays in college, and then this program that's at the New School, the Actor Studio program, mm-hmm. had kind of a satellite program. I think it was before they even started it at the New School. And Shelley Winters and Ellen Burstyn came down and, you know, taught for a bit, and Carlton Collier and all these people that are studio people came down, and they wanted non-actors, you know, people who are not in the theater department, because, you know, I think there's a little bit in the Actor Studio, there's a little bit of this idea that the best actors are going to be the ones who didn't want to be actors or something. You know, there's some sort of... it's a romanticization of what it means to be an actor, you know. We found this guy kind of thing. And so I was drawn to it just because I wanted to meet famous people. And I, you know, this class in particular. And I was very influenced by the ideas because it's sort of a somewhat intellectual way into acting, you know. I liked the idea behind it.
Now you said you got into acting in part because you wanted to meet famous people. Now that you've mm-hmm. met and worked with a lot of famous people, is meeting famous people still of any interest?
Meeting people that are, I would say not meeting famous people, but meeting people that I respect is always interesting, you know, that I've respected from afar. That said, it's very difficult to act with somebody that you respect in that way.
Why?
Oh, because there's a distancing thing that happens. I mean, for example, if you're supposed to, if your lover in the film is an actor that, like, I've watched in movies since, you know, say the early 90s or something like that after I got out of college, and I have to be intimate with them, they're still going to be kind of in my head from these other movies. And so there's a process that takes... usually, I think, a very brief period of time, depending on how willing they are to drop it. It's really up to that person to let go of the... it's empowering to have that kind of respect. And it's up to them to let go of that power in order to act with you.
Who has that happened with?
I've been fortunate. It's happened with a number... you know, with Liam Neeson, it happened with me. Actually, Liam plays, and I play a kind of, we are basically lovers in Kinsey. I mean, his wife is also my lover in the movie, so it's a little bit confusing. But I, you know, grew up watching Liam Neeson in movies, and he's got this incredible power and charisma as an actor, and it's difficult to imagine that person being your lover if you've seen them in movies for all that length of time. So, but Liam is exactly the kind of guy that lets go of that kind of power the moment you meet him, or, you know, tries to. And then it's up to the two of you to negotiate some new relationship, you know.
Did Sean Penn let go of that power when he was killing you in Dead Man Walking, or did he keep that power so as to better be forceful with you?
Uh-huh. Yeah, he kept it. I mean, I think... there was no reason for him to let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it absolutely depends on the role. I mean, some of the time it can work to your advantage. Harrison Ford in K-19 never let go of it with me, and it's because he played my commanding officer, and he was the Daddy Warbucks that I had to go talk to when everything was going wrong, and it was much better if he kind of kept that enormous presence that he has. And... all I could do was react to it, and you know, he, so many of the circumstances in that movie were true to life. I'd never been on a nuclear submarine before. My character had never been on a nuclear submarine before, and was asked to be the guy who took care of the heart of the machine, the reactor officer. You know, I'd never been on a $100 million movie before. I'd never acted with, you know, Harrison Ford in this situation, and I was entrusted with a very significant part of the story, kind of the heart of the movie in some ways. And it was incredibly intimidating, and every day was very stressful for me on that movie. But I think it looks right in the film. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter Sarsgaard, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Peter Sarsgaard speaking with Terry Gross last year. Sarsgaard's now starring in Garden State. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film We Don't Live Here Anymore. It's based on two stories by Andre Debuse. This is Fresh Air. The film We Don't Live Here Anymore is a new family drama about marriage based on the work of the late Andre Debuse. The ensemble cast includes Laura Dern, Mark Ruffalo, Naomi Watts, and Peter Krause. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Tolstoy wrote that each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, and I would add that when it comes to marriage, especially with children, each unhappy couple reinvents the wheel, the torture wheel. Each of us, after all, has a different threshold for four-letter words and infidelities and all the other forms of emotional battery that you'll find in We Don't Live Here Anymore, which is like a bad marriage greatest hits collection. The movie is based on two related novellas by the late Andre Debuse, and it's not a film to see if you're contemplating tying the knot. In fact, it's a workout if you're already entwined. The movie is a chamber drama for four. There's practically no one else in the thing but two couples and their children. The men are Jack, played by Mark Ruffalo, and Hank, played by Peter Krause. They're college English department academics with beards, but they're also pretty fit, and their regular running dates turn into macho competitions. On a related front, they're playing out a more perverse game that involves seducing each other's wives. Jack's wife, Terry, is played by Laura Dern, and Naomi Watts is Edith, who's married to Krause's Hank. When we meet these four, they're drunk in Jack and Terry's kitchen. Jack and Edith, that's Ruffalo and Watts if you're keeping score, go off to buy beer. They smooch, declare their desire, and make a date for the next day. Krause's Hank doesn't miss this. His own affairs are legion, and he has designs on the miserably unhappy Terry. Miserably isn't a word I use lightly. Laura Dern turns Terry into one of the more full-throttled, neglected spouses in the annals of film. She's so haggard it's alarming, and her mouth, which has always been mobile, is now halfway to claymation. It's constantly collapsing and reforming. It's no wonder Ruffalo's Jack squirms when she's in his face.
We've been married so long that you're bored? Is that it?
Terry.
No, is that what it is? Because you can leave any time.
Terry.
I mean, maybe you and I should sit down and talk about how long
Terry.
This thing is going to last between you and me.
I am not
no,
going
fine,
anywhere.
Jack.
I have never
will
wanted
be fine,
to go anywhere.
You know, if you're
I am
suffering,
not suffering,
if this
and
such
I am
a
not...
disappointment.
What are you really worried about, Terry?
Other husbands touch their wives.
Do you see Hank fondling Edith every second?
Hank doesn't love her. He told me when you were out.
He said that to you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Why? Why did he tell you that?
I don't know. He just said it.
What he was doing? He just blurted that out? Seems odd.
We were talking. How else do people tell each other things?
Well, usually when people say things like that, they're doing other things.
You have to understand, We Don't Live Here Anymore doesn't build to that scene. The movie starts at that level and keeps climbing. Even the lame excuses of the furtive lovers as they head out the door to take the car in or do some work in the library hit you like blows, especially when the needy kids are being lied to, along with the spouses. The film is presented more or less from the perspective of Ruffalo's Jack, but it doesn't take his side, or anyone else's side. They're all in their way suffering. The director, John Curran, made an Australian film called Praise, which was like Sid and Nancy if you took away the violence and satire and rock and roll and left only the grasping. This movie ups that grasping quotient. It's rooted less in a film tradition than in the suburban spouse-swapping novels of the early 70s, only not so glib. The 70s is when Debuse wrote these stories, and when the screenwriter Larry Gross adapted them, and the movie is dated by the fact that these women don't have careers or hobbies. But the ebb and flow and overflow of the characters' emotions exert a strong pull on our own. Jack is a sensitive guy, but his passivity towards his wife is a form of cruelty. He pretends to be asleep while in his car out front his best friend seduces Terry, and then he takes sadistic pleasure in letting her know he saw everything. You look at Jack and think, what's eating him? Is he just not ready to grow up and accept responsibility for his family? He certainly has a scary role model in Krause's Hank, who has that monumental sense of self-entitlement you see in artists who decide their work gives them license to indulge their every fleeting desire. Some critics have accused the movie of being too florid, too undiluted, too much. But I think in that muchness, it approaches the psychological condition of marriage. Often the camera is so close that the character's pain twists you up. Then you're distanced by floating long shots. The score by Michael Covertino is full of spooky, disharmonic shimmers, like astral winds. It's perfect music for people too much on top of each other, yet lost in space.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of Retirement for Two, Everything You Need to Know to Thrive Together as Long as You Both Shall Live, by Marianne Vandervelde, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next Fresh Air, it's our big, bombastic, brassy, and trashy week, and we begin with Big. Rudy Belmer on the making of the 1933 film King Kong, and Steve Rifle on the original 1954 uncut version of Godzilla. Join us for the next Fresh Air.